been preaching through the book of John, and I was, I'd let you in on a secret maybe, or my thinking about this. I've been, the older I get, the more experience I get with just being alive and trying to live my Christianity, my beliefs out in the world, you gain different perspectives. You know, when I was young, I used to think, these old people keep talking about wisdom that you can only get from being old. What on earth are they talking about? Whatever they know, they can just tell me and I'll know it too. What is the problem? Why do you have to be old to know these things? Well, you don't have to be old to know some things. But if you're like me, it just takes a long time to learn things you should know. And I used to think I knew a lot more than I actually did. I don't know if any of young people are listening to me, if you relate to anything to what I'm saying, but whatever you think you know now, there may be some time in the future that you'll be thinking, wait, is that really so? What is that anyway? And you'll find yourself rethinking some of the things that right now you take for granted. And because of that process, I look at some things that I know very well in the Bible with a different perspective. Different perspective. And I've been wanted to go through the book of John to see if this thought I'm having these days is really true. That Jesus came to bring a radically different way of relating to God, and that the people who had the hardest time understanding what Jesus was saying were the people who knew the Bible, were the people who had already committed themselves to follow God. They had the hardest time hearing what Jesus had to say. And I wanted to look through the book of John to see if this is really the case, if this is really what John is saying. I've gone through John chapter 1 already, and so I've talked a lot about what is already in there. You know, there are some things that are not in John chapter 1 that John just simply does not even mention, that we all know very well. For example, John chapter 1, there is no story at all about Jesus being born. Nothing about his birth. We're just coming up on Christmas, where the whole season is about Jesus being born, born of a Virgin Mary, and coming from Nazareth to Bethlehem, where because of and you know the stories, you know about Herod, you know about the wise men, you know about the angels. None of that is in John at all. Doesn't even mention it. Doesn't even mention it. Another thing that John does not mention, he doesn't mention anything about Jesus at the age of 12. Still a boy, but on the verge of what they considered manhood in the Jewish tradition. He goes down to Jerusalem. You remember that story? And he ended up in theological debates, discussions with the Pharisees and the scribes and the priests. And he was so involved with that that his mom and dad took off back for Bethlehem and realized that he wasn't even there. That isn't in John at all. Another thing that is not in the book of John is John being baptized. That's another thing we know of. So these are some of the major events that we know about in Jesus' life that John doesn't even mention. What he does say, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and this Word, he was the light of the world, he came to the world, and the world didn't recognize him. That's what John did say. And what John did say is that John the Baptist, that everyone realized was a prophet, was saying there's someone coming after me who's greater than me. And Jesus passes by and John says, that's him. That is him. That's what John does say. Another thing that is not mentioned in the book of John that happened right after that, that we know about, is his 40 days in the wilderness being tempted. We know that story very well. That's not in the book of John at all. It's amazing what is not there, as well as what is there. John could have spent a lot of time on all of these. You know, sometimes I think what is left out is just as important to know why it was left out, or it says something. You say a lot by saying nothing sometimes. Because John was trying, there was something more important that John was trying. John was trying to be efficient with his message. He could have spent a lot of time talking about things that actually were true, things that actually did happen, things that actually were important, but not as important as his main message. He had to make some decisions of what to cut out. You know, that is the hardest part about preaching. Knowing what not to say. Because there's all sorts of things you want, if you're like me anyway, there's tangents you want to go off into, and you talk about this, talk about that, and you end up talking about everything, and nobody knows what on earth you're saying. It's just as important to know what to leave out sometimes so that your main point can be made. That being said, there are some things that are mentioned that I have no idea why it's in there. The reason I say that is, if you're like me, I'm kind of suspicious of people who think they have the Bible all figured out. Because if you're like me, some things you read in the Bible, you go, what? What? What are they talking about? And if you're like me, some years later, you go back to that and you go, oh, now I know what they're talking about. And there are some things still today that I still look at it and go, what? Why is that even mentioned? Maybe someday, the light will come on in my head and I'll go, oh. What about some of the things that I don't know why it's there that are in John chapter 1 is Jesus, for some reason, thought it was important to tell Nathanael he was under a fig tree. What? Why is a fig tree important? Well, I have some idea, because that's the fact that Jesus knew that about Nathanael convinced Nathanael that Jesus was something special. Another thing that's in John 1 that I don't know why it's there, why it's even mentioned, since there's so many other important things that are left out, is that after Jesus talks with Nathanael and Andrew and Simon, and they all follow him, it says he decided to go to Galilee. Why is that important? I have no idea. But he did go to Galilee. So that's kind of where we pick up in John 2. Another thing that it starts off by saying in John 2 is that on the third day, Jesus decides to go to Galilee. Why is that third day important? I have no idea. Maybe you have some idea about why that's important. If so, let me know. You could teach me something. And maybe sometime in the future, I'll know why it was important for John to mention that on the third day, he decides to leave to Galilee. But whatever the reason was, Jesus is now back in Galilee. Galilee, by the way, is sort of like a county or a state. It's an area of the country of Israel. And it's, you might think of it sort of like maybe Alaska. You know, Alaska is a state. It's one of the United States. They have two senators, they have congressmen and everything. But it's not physically connected with the other 48. Same thing with Hawaii. Galilee was sort of like that. There's the land of Israel with Jerusalem. And then Galilee was sort of up north. There was Samaria in between. So it was sort of not connected, but still part of Israel. And that's where Jesus had grown up, in a town called Nazareth. And so that's where his mother lived. That's where his siblings lived. So let's pick up with John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there. Must have been some family friend or something. And Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. So somehow people knew who Jesus was. This is a kind of his hometown. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Told this to Jesus. "Woman, why do you involve me?" It's a good question. I kind of wonder why Mary thought it was important to tell Jesus about this too. It wasn't Jesus' wedding. It wasn't one of his siblings' weddings. It may have been a friend of the family, perhaps. But it was a problem for this family. And so Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me? What do I have to do with this? My hour has not yet come." So Jesus was waiting for something. And somehow Mary's request to Jesus had something to do with something that was yet to come with Jesus. Doesn't really say what it was. We get some hints later on, perhaps in this chapter. "My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to his servants, "Do whatever he tells you." This tells me something about Mary, that even though Jesus was saying, "My hour has not yet come," she knew that he could do something. That somehow he was going to be able to somehow fix this situation. She didn't know how, but she wanted everybody to know, whatever he says, do it. cooperate with him, because he has the answers to this situation. I had a friend of mine, well, actually, he wasn't a friend of mine, but he was a professor of mine in Bible college. He used to say sometimes he would do revivals in areas where there was large Catholic population, and he used to advertise a title of one sermon that he would preach. And the title of the sermon was, "The Only Commandment Mary Ever Gave." You want to hear the only commandment Mary ever gave? And here it is. Verse 5. Do whatever he tells you to do. Do whatever Jesus tells you to do. Verse 6. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind of that the Jews used for ceremonial washing, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to his servants, "Fill the jar with water." Jesus is going to do something. So they did what Mary told them to do. They did what Jesus said. So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." No fanfare, no public display that anything spectacular was happening. He didn't say, "Your faith has made this water into wine." He didn't proclaim that something was going to happen and put on a show. He did not even mention that anything special was going to happen or did happen. He just said, "Take some of the water out and give it to the master of the banquet." Okay, so they did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. When did that happen? Doesn't say. How did it happen? Doesn't say. It just happened. You know, sometimes that's how God works. You don't know that God has done something special until after the fact. Till he's already done it, and you go, "Whoa, how did this happen? What? I have no idea." You know, there was a time in my life when I was in a very low point. I had just lost a job that I had had for 15 years, a job that I thought this was God's calling on my life. This is what God put me on earth here to do. I was sure I was in the center of God's will. And the human resources director pulled me aside and said, "This is your last day of work. Here are your termination papers. And the only place it isn't filled out is whether you are being terminated or whether you're resigning. Which will it be?" I was devastated. I was floored. We weren't making much money. At that time, part of my frustration was that here I was working at this job and somehow not able to scrape enough money to pay the bills and without this fear of financial ruin just looming over my head. And we had some debts. And now, bam, that job was gone. I thought, "Oh, man. What is going to happen? I don't know." But I put it in God's hands. 1 year later, before I had been rehired, When I finally did get a new job, the debts were gone. We never missed a meal, never missed a house payment, and the debts were gone. I don't know how that happened. I actually do not know how that happened. Somehow it did. Once we got the money started rolling in, guess what happened? Oh, yeah, now we can borrow. We're finally pulling out of that debt again, right about when it's time for me to retire. Why do I mention that? At my lowest point where I did not have a way to make a way, God proved, did a miracle that to me is no less than turning water into wine. Somehow, the money coming in erased our debt, did not damage any financial situation we were in, and we had no need. We didn't go without either. Never missed a meal. Still had clothes to wear. Still had heat in the house. How did that happen? I do not know. But God did it. Sometimes that is how God works. You don't even know that He's doing miraculous things in your life until after it's already done. You go look back and go, wait. How did I end up in this good position? Because God has been at work. The master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink. But you saved the best wine until now. That's what he noticed. So who at this point knew that a miracle had taken place? Almost nobody. Only the people that had obeyed what Jesus told them to do. Those are the only people who knew something special had happened. Jesus didn't give an explanation for why he did this, which, by the way, from this point on in the book of John, that's the pattern. Jesus will do a miracle, and then he'll give a speech about why he did it. This didn't happen here. Maybe it was because his hour had not yet come. The only people who knew about it were the people who chose to obey what he told them to do. The bridegroom didn't know what had happened. All he knew is, oh, well, I guess that's one need I don't have anymore. And I don't know where this wine that he's talking about came from. I only bought one kind of wine. I don't know. And the master of the banquet just only noticed, wow, something is different, something is better. But that's all. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed him. So there was ways that Jesus was revealing his glory. By the way, the word glory in the Old Testament especially is very, very closely tied to light. Light. There was in the temple and on the Ark of the Covenant, The Bible mentions God's Shekinah glory would shine from that. Glory, light. What did it say in John 1? Jesus was the light of the world that came into the world, and the world didn't even recognize him. But here's the first way that Jesus was revealing some of his glory. And his disciples believed him. Verse 13, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. It mentions going up to Jerusalem. This is a little trivia in case you are interested. Jesus went up to Jerusalem. If you look on a map, I mean, they probably didn't have maps the same way we do now, but Jerusalem was south of Galilee. I would have said gone down because of the way I think of maps and stuff. But it was up to Jerusalem because Jerusalem was up on a hill. So Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So once again, he's leaving Galilee, going back around Samaria, or maybe through Samaria, into Jerusalem. Why? Because it was almost time for the Passover. The Passover was one of the two that I can think of. One of the two annual events that if you're a good Jew, if you're obeying the Bible, doing what God says, you are going to go to Jerusalem for the Passover and the Pentecost. You're just going to do that. So Jesus, it's time for the Passover. So Jesus is going to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." And his disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove that your authority to do this?" They had no idea who Jesus was. They couldn't care less who he was unless there was some authority to do this. And there's because Jesus seemed to be speaking in kind of moralistic terms. You know, they couldn't just write him off as a crazy person. Every once in a while, a crazy person might just come in and do stuff like that, but you have no idea why he's doing it. But Jesus said, "This is why I'm doing it. You're turning this place into a den of thieves." And so he's not just completely irrational. "What authority do you do this?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." This temple. The temple was in Jerusalem, by the way. They were in the temple. There's outer parts of the temple. and then there's the altar where all the sacrifices were made. And the altar, going beyond that, well, you're in the holy place that are, you, not everybody could go. But the outer area, anybody could be there. And part of the reason what you do in Passover is to make sacrifices. So that's why everybody was there. And if you're like someone traveling from Galilee, perhaps, like Jesus, Bringing a goat or a cow or something, it might be a little cumbersome, but you needed to present a sacrifice. So they had designed a way to meet both these needs. You can come to Jerusalem and obey God by offering sacrifices, even though you don't bring your own. We'll sell you an animal. You bring your money, you give it to us, we'll give you the animal so that you can sacrifice. Sounds completely legitimate, doesn't it? Completely legitimate. Well, it is completely illegitimate, but what is not legitimate is extortion. What's not legitimate is profiting your own well-being by taking advantage of others. Whenever there's a dire need, or people are kind of over the barrel and need something desperately, like toilet paper in these times, right? What happens in the stores? People need it, people want it, and so the price goes up. We call it price gouging. Well, this happened all the time right here. People knew they needed to sacrifice to God, and so they were price gougers right there in the temple. That's what Jesus was angry about. What authority? What authority do you have, Jesus, for doing this? And his response, if you were there at the time, you had no idea that Jesus was going to be killed and raised from the dead in about 3 years. That hadn't happened yet. All you know is this guy is coming in, turning over money changers' table, throwing out people from the temple, saying crazy stuff. And why the authority for him to do this? He's saying, tear down this temple and I will build it up. What? That just doesn't make... Now, if I were the people at the time, I'd think, this man really has lost it. He's saying stuff that makes no sense whatsoever. I think he's divorced from reality. But his disciples remember him saying this. Jesus was talking about his own body. The authority for him doing this, he said, you want to know my authority? I'll show you my authority by raising myself out of the grave. Yeah, you kill this body, and you know what? I'll show you that I mean what I say and that I have the authority to say what I'm saying because I'm going to raise myself out of the grave. When that happens, you'll know what I am saying has authority. In fact, I'd kind of jumped ahead a little bit here. They replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? The 46 years, by the way, this was what's called Herod's temple. There's actually three different temples on the same site in Jerusalem over the years. The first one, I don't know if it took 46 years. I kind of get the sense it didn't take that long. But that was Solomon's temple. Solomon built a temple, and it was glorious. It was magnificent. It was wonderful. And then when the Babylonians came and destroyed the land, they tore down the temple. That was gone. After they came back from Babylon, Zerubbabel rebuilt the temple. once again, they said, you know, this is our land. God has brought us back to the land of Israel. We need to rebuild the temple. Now, the people, the Bible says, the people who saw the temple that they'd rebuilt cried because it was nothing like Solomon's temple. You could not recreate the glory of Solomon's temple. So that was Zerubbabel's temple. And then after a while, that also was destroyed. And King Herod, I think it might have been Herod the Great, the same guy who tried to kill Jesus when he was first born, he rebuilt the temple. Took him 46 years, the Bible says here. So this was a fairly new temple, and people were excited about having a temple to worship in again. And Jesus said, tear down this temple. It's already been torn down twice. And by the way, would be torn down again not too long after this. And Jesus said, I will raise it up. So people thought they were talking about the temple that they were in. But the temple is the physical dwelling place on earth of God. Jesus was God dwelling on planet earth. The temple was no longer at this point that physical structure. The temple was Jesus himself. He was living bodily on planet Earth in front of them. I think he was saying exactly the truth. Destroy this temple, me, my body, the place where I am now living on earth, and you'll think you'll have destroyed me. But I'll show you that what I'm saying has authority. I'll show you by raising myself out of the grave. Verse 22. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. And they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Sometimes you don't know the meaning of what Jesus says, about what God says, until after something else happens. There may be things you read in the Bible, and you go, what? Just like I said earlier, what does this have to do with me? I just don't get it. Then something will happen in your life, and you'll remember what the Bible said, and you'll go, oh, that's what he was trying to tell me. Lights will come on. So one of the things that we start to see here is Jesus, the very first public thing he does in his ministry is he confronts established religious practices. He confronts people who are making money from something that seemed to make perfect sense from what the Bible says people need to do. Make sacrifices. Jesus stands up and says, you people are greedy bastards. Didn't use that word, I don't think. But he said something that showed his anger, for sure. You are a den of thieves. The very first thing he does is controversial. The very first thing he does is confrontational. The Pharisees will turn up in the book of John and other places. not mentioned in this story particularly, but we do know some things about the Pharisees. One is they benefited financially from their piety. They were trying to do what God says to do and got paid for it. And in Luke 16, it just kind of mentions one little phrase in passing. Now, the Pharisees, by the way, were the Bible-believing, God-fearing Jews who took the Bible seriously and really tried to obey what it said. That's who the Pharisees were. Luke 16:14 says, the Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering, etc., etc. Pharisees loved money. It's very easy to appear and to even convince ourselves that we are trying our best to obey God. And the bottom line is we love money. Why do we do things the way God says? Because if we do it this way, we're gonna be financially secure. Sometimes preachers will actually preach that God wants you rich. And if you do things the way God says, then you are going to be rich. And in fact, if you want to be richer, give. The Bible says, if you give to God, he'll bless you. So give to my ministry and God will bless you. When the love of money is really the motive behind what we're obeying God, we have become the Pharisees. We have become the Pharisees. And I know I've been guilty of the very first thing I said. I didn't spend enough time cutting out some of the stuff that I was supposed to spend time cutting off, and I apologize for that. Verse 23, now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. I want to stop right there. Many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. That sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? That sounds like a positive thing. And many times it's easy to believe that coming to a faith in Jesus because of signs, and that's really the basis for everything, is a good thing. It can be, but look what comes next. But Jesus did not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. Yeah, so somehow this faith that they had in Jesus did not result in Jesus entrusting himself to them. Why? Well, I think it doesn't say specifically, but I have some thoughts about why. If we believe in Jesus just because of the spectacular miracles he did, it's kind of the same thing as believing in David Copperfield because of the great magic shows he performs. Nobody knows who David Copperfield is. He's from the 70s, right? Who's a big magician now? David Blaine. Okay. Everyone knows who David Blaine is, right? Nobody know. You don't know who David Blaine is? Oh, well. It's not important, except He's a great performer of magic, and people are wowed. And if that's what your faith in Jesus is about, it's not enough. It's not enough. It does not change a person's heart. Jesus said he knew, did not need testimony from other people, but he knew what was in each person's heart. Even though they believed in him, they knew their heart wasn't changed. And therefore, he was not going to entrust himself to them. Belief in Jesus just based on spectacular miracles is not enough for Jesus to trust himself to us. Belief, however, that is a change in attitude is a change of heart. Just this week, I was reminded, I guess I knew this before, but it really kind of hit me this week. I was reminded that faith and love, what is it, the three big things in 1 Corinthians 13? Faith, hope, and love. The greatest of these is love. You know, now that I think of it, right here as I'm standing, all three of these have something in common. They can be described as an attitude put into action. An attitude put into an action. Not necessarily a feeling. The feelings many times comes along with it, and it is certainly an enjoyable thing to have a feeling of love for God, to have a feeling of love towards people. But if the feeling's not there, and that's what love is to us, we're probably not going to act the same way. And, you know, I've kind of heard it said, if somebody says to somebody, "I love you," what are they really saying? Are they saying they're interested in that other person? Or are they really saying, "I love how you make me feel"? "I love this feeling I have when I think about you." Those are two different things. We can be in love with our feeling. We can enjoy the feeling of love. We can enjoy the feeling of hope. We can enjoy the feeling of faith. See, this is about faith here, believing in Jesus. People who saw the signs, man, it's a thrilling thing to see those things. Oh, we get excited. We get a good feeling when we see Jesus performing some spectacular sign. That is not the same thing as an attitude in action. I'm not downplaying the important or how good it is to have that feeling. That's a wonderful thing when we have it. But don't be mistaken. That's not the same thing as faith. Faith is just as love is, just as hope is. These are attitudes in action. An attitude is where we have decided something in our head about what is true. And we believe this thing to be true about this person or this circumstance, and so we are going to act accordingly. Some parents sometimes complain about teenagers' attitudes. Am I right? Because we know that they have decided already before they even listen to us, that they have this all figured out, that they are going to, there are some things that they just discount what us wise older people are telling them that it's the wisest thing to do. Or we've set down some guidelines, some rules, and the teenager says, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's right. And therefore, you may force me to do this, but you just wait. Because I'm going to find some way around this sometime. So that's what an attitude is. When we have decided in ourselves, for ourselves, something to be true. The parents don't know what they're talking about. We've decided for ourselves that person over there only has my worst interest at heart. That person is just out to get me. I've already decided that. And I'm going to behave on that basis. We've already decided that the best way to get rich is to buy Bitcoin. I've already decided this, and I'm going to act on that basis. That's an attitude in action. So these people could have seen Jesus doing these signs, had a great feeling about it, but had no change in attitude. What change in attitude would have been appropriate for them? Well, the change in attitude would have been to say, this is God on earth, and I need to submit myself to him. He is trying to tell me something, and I need to do whatever he says to do if I'm going to be on the good side of the God of the universe. That's a change of attitude that the people who believed in him did not make. People who believed in Jesus because of the signs did not make that change of attitude. And therefore, Jesus did not entrust himself to them. I guess I want to close by asking a question. Has Jesus entrusted himself to you? You may have had belief in Jesus on one level because you're amazed at the incredibly powerful miracles he did. You may have been impressed by stories you've heard, people you've known. How many people here have known personally? You know someone that had some dreadful disease that God healed them from. Raise your hand. If you know people who are like that, some of you have not had the privilege yet, some of us have. And that is a wonderful, spectacular thing to see happen. But the real question is, has your heart changed? Because when our attitude changes about Jesus, that's when he can entrust himself to us. I still don't know exactly what that means. In this passage, perhaps it meant Jesus knew without that change of heart, it's just a matter of time before they're going to kill him, which ended up did happening. That is what happened. But he knew that wasn't time yet. He had to keep himself away from people in some level or other who did not have this change in attitude because there were things he needed to do first. Maybe that's what that was talking about. That's what makes sense to me. But Jesus, I guess, would like to entrust himself to us. And he's waiting for our change in attitude for him to do that. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.